I want us to look at this bloke Abraham because he seems to me to be a type of the sort of person who is really prepared to walk with God. With God having given the instructions, I've taken hold of you, mate, so that the nations may be blessed. And I want us to think about that and see what it meant for Abraham in this chapter to really be a man of faith, a person of faith. And I want to give you just a few headings to think about. The first is this. Faith meant moving for God's purposes. Look at verses 8 to 10. When he was called to go to a place he would later receive as his inheritance, he obeyed and went, even though he didn't know where he was going. Made his home in a promised land, like a stranger in a foreign country. He lived in tents. Imagine if Abraham had been the sort of bloke who said, well, I'll serve you as long as it can be in Ur. Because Ur was where he was brought up, you see, and Ur was not a crummy hole. It was a very significant place. If you read the biblical archaeologist Donald Wiseman's stuff, you will find out what sort of place it was. And Abraham, being a fairly wealthy bloke, would have had a massive mansion with a wonderful master bedroom and sort of libraries and bathrooms and all this sort of thing. He's going to go and live in a grotty tent. Ur was not a backwoods place. Ur was a rather splendid city for those times. And imagine him saying to the Lord, yes, I'll serve you as long as it's here, but you can't serve God on your terms. And one of the things that we find in Scripture is that in one real sense there's no settling down. Because the God of the Bible assumes that his people will be mobile. The Great Commission is not go and make disciples of all nations. It's going, make disciples. Go isn't a command, it's an assumption that you'll be on the move. As God himself is on the move. There's a problem when they wanted to build the temple. God says, well, I'm not that sort of God actually. I've always been on the move living in a tent with my people. Where they move, I move. Then you get Ezekiel, and Ezekiel begins off with wheels, going right, left and centre, doesn't it? And his vision of God is all bound up with wheels. And one of the messages that Ezekiel had to get across to people, our God's mobile. Our God's on the move in this earth. Our God is not localised. He's not a tin pot God that lives there but not somewhere else, and that we're blessed there but not here, or vice versa. And so Abraham, you see, had to learn a new concept of security. Often we think of security in terms of a familiar environment. Or we think of security in terms of things that are precious to us. Or we think of security in terms of living in a society where everything's provided. Or do we think of our security in terms of our relationship with God? That he is the rock. That he is the thing that makes everything secure. I find that many are prepared to sacrifice their walk with God in order to have what the world calls security. The question that comes to me as I look at Abraham here is, will you go where the Lord calls? And it's fundamentally a question of trust. By faith, Abraham, when called, obeyed. Do you trust him? He sang lots of choruses about me and my enjoyment of God, but do you actually trust him? It's a very important question. You see what it meant for Abraham to be willing to go? It meant that he was willing to go when he didn't have all his questions answered. Isn't that fascinating? He didn't actually know where he was going. There were lots of unanswered questions when this bloke set off. You see, guidance doesn't mean knowing all the answers to all the questions. It means knowing enough to get a move on. But not all the answers. And it teaches us, it seems to me, that as we look at this, that we are to obey what we know and then walk on with him. God may have convicted you this time in relation to your commitment to missions. You may know that you've got to pray, but you're not quite sure whether you've got to go. Well, you don't need to let us know that at the moment, but you obey in what you know. You say, well, I don't know where it'll lead if I really start praying for Asia. Well, never mind, he didn't know where it would lead either. But he knew that he got to do that much. And faith was a willingness to go when he didn't have all his questions answered. It was a willingness to go when he didn't know what he'd get out of it. You see what it says in verse 3? It says, well, he knew that, not verse 3, verse 8, beg its pardon. It says, he knew that the Lord would provide. He knew he was going to receive a place as an inheritance. But when you think about it, when Abraham went out, there was no support from Ur. And yes, the Lord provided a tent. Good night. You know, you move from a mansion to a tent. Well, it's all right for a holiday, isn't it? But he wasn't talking about a holiday, he was talking about three generations of it. He was talking about a life and a life and a life in a tent. And he left Ur. Yes, there was provision. He knew that the Lord would provide. The Lord did provide, not affluence in that sense of a lovely building. The Lord sometimes does provide affluence. Later, Abraham seemed to do fairly well, even though he still had a tent. But the Lord would provide. He didn't know what, but he knew he could trust the Lord. That's important as well, isn't it? We can panic sometimes as we go out with the Lord. As you know, in UK, and I think you do here in some respects too, we have a nationalised health service. One of the things that really hit me when I went to the Philippines was I suddenly realised I couldn't afford to be sick. I really could not afford to be sick. I had, I suppose, about $200 in my pocket when I went to the Philippines. And that's not very much when you're going to get married out there and set up your home. And I suddenly realised I couldn't afford to be sick, and I panicked. A night in a hospital in Manila is about the same price as a night in the Hilton Hotel. And that's before you pay the doctor. And it blew my mind. And it frightened me. It needn't have done. I could tell you some mind-blowing stories of the way that the Lord provided. And we had our share of illness in the Philippines. On three occasions, I had doctors tell me that members of my family were not going to live. And each time they're all there still. But we had quite a bit of hospital expenses. Sometimes the Lord touched people who didn't know about it in Britain. Sometimes the Lord touched people in the Philippines that I never thought would be able to afford a penny, let alone what they paid. But the Lord knew what he was about, and he knew that he could provide. But you don't have it all cut and dried before you go, neither did Abraham. He knew God, not the bank balance. He was willing to go when he wouldn't belong. It says there that he went into a promised land like a stranger in a foreign country. Now that's a very important thing, you see, because folks say, well, I'll go and have a look-see and see if I feel at home. Why should that be the category? Somebody said to me, well, do the Japanese welcome you? Do they want the gospel? He says, no, they don't want the gospel. They don't want the gospel. They don't think they need the gospel. They're not interested in the gospel. They don't want the gospel. You may sometimes feel very much like a stranger. When we first arrived in the Philippines, we spent quite a lot of our time working with highly politicalized Marxist young people. As you walk through the street, they'd shout out, go home, Joe. Go home, Joe. Go home, Joe. Y bagsak ang mga Americano. Down with the whites. And they flung Rosemary off a moving bus when she was 8 months pregnant, because she was white. Sometimes it's hard to be a stranger, a foreigner. It is, you know. Sometimes embarrassing the other way around. Some folk had a colonial mentality. One little boy stood up in a bus to give me a seat. I felt such a fool, I couldn't fit into it. But it's funny, it's difficult to be odd and different, and to have a little following. If I feel at home, if I like being there. It says about Abraham, he made his home there. He was a stranger, he was a foreigner, he didn't belong there, but he made his home there. He didn't have a tourist mindset. He settled there because God wanted him to be his man there. And he made his home there in the sense that he decided, I'm going to belong there. I'm not always going to be looking over my shoulder at and hankering for that. Willing to go for Abraham meant willing to go when the children would be affected. I want you to notice what happened here. There were three generations who lived in tents because of his decision. The sacrifice was for the children as well, and the promises were for the children too. Notice that, will you? It's the two things. The sacrifice was for the children. Some people talk these days and say, your religion shouldn't cause any problems or need any sacrifice for your children. You have no right to ask them to do that. You have no right to deprive them of anything for the sake of the gospel. I believe that the worst deprivation we can give our children is to give them parents who dilute their discipleship. Diluted discipleship, and that as the example and leadership, is one of the worst things we can pass on to our kids. Our children will know what it is to sacrifice. But our children have the right to enter into the promises of God and to prove God in the cost. I remember when the Lord was fighting with us to call us to Scotland, and I must tell you quite frankly that we did not want to go to Scotland, and we still find it quite difficult in some ways to be English living in Scotland, especially to adjust to the Scottish ecclesiastical culture, which is very solemn, which you will understand is not quite the way that I am. When we were thinking about it, we shared it with our children because it is our conviction that since the children have got to pay for it with us, the children must be praying in it for us in relation to the call and everything. And I shall never forget Andrew at 5 praying, dear Lord Jesus, if you want us to go to Scotland, please make it that we go and don't argue about it. And if you don't want us to go to Scotland, please make it that we don't go and don't argue about that either. So that, you see, when we arrived in Scotland, Andrew had 2 days in school, and he came home and said, Daddy, how long is it going to take us to learn the language in this country? He wrote a letter to Jesus in which he could say to Jesus in this letter, Lord Jesus, you have brought us here. Now, Lord Jesus, will you please give us some friends? In other words, yes, there was sacrifice for Andrew in leaving all the security of the place that he had begun to belong in. But the promises were as real for him and to be entered into for him as for us. And we do need to take that into account. Like the little girl I was telling you about, his parents said, we think we've got to go to Korea. She says, then we must ask the Lord Jesus to make us very brave, mustn't we? The promises and the sacrifice and the opportunity for the kids with us to prove the Lord is there. But he made decisions that affected the family for 3 generations. Willing to go also meant that he was willing when there would be no quick results. You see, it says in verse 8 that he went to a place where he would later receive as his inheritance. Later. Was later, wasn't it? They had 3 jolly generations of looking forward to that receiving before they got it. A bit like that work amongst the Muslims in South Thailand we were talking about, isn't it? 20 years work. How many baptized? 1. 15 years work in the Philippines amongst the Muslims. How many baptized? None yet. But with that lovely promise in Galatians 6, in due season, let us not grow weary in well-doing, for in due season we shall reap if we don't lose heart. Now that's a very important mindset, do you see? Because there are plenty of folk who say, well, I will go as long as I can come back with a scalp, my belt surrounded with the scalps of the converts as quickly as possible. And in some places you may have that privilege. But the call of God is a willingness to go, whoops, even if you have to wait for the results. Now how could Abraham live this sort of life? Because it's demanding, isn't it? It's not a cushy number. How could he do it? It tells us in verse 10. It says, because, or for, which means because. Because he was looking forward to the city with foundations, whose architect and builder is God. He looked forward to a city. Are you looking forward to a city? Very important for us to look forward, because we can easily be distracted by present appearances. Like the devil tried to distract Jesus. You know, he took him onto a mountain. He says, look at all these kingdoms of the world. He says, they're mine, says Satan. It's a bit of a cheek to say that to Jesus, but that's what he tries. It's the great con trick. Look at all the problems. Look at all the impossibilities. Look at all the peoples that aren't responding. Look at all the peoples that are under my thumb, says Satan. It's all mine. He says, I'm looking forward to a city. Do you look forward to the city? The future, you see, is not in nirvana, this peculiar sort of Hindu and Buddhist idea where you as an individual sort of dissolve like a drop in the ocean and cease to exist as you. The vision that you've got in Revelation is of the city, the New Jerusalem, which, as it puts it in Revelation chapter 7, who's there? Well, there are people from every tribe and tongue and nation, every ethnic group, every language group, every sort of person is there, thrilled to bits with the salvation of Jesus. And it's a community that works. The people of God. He says, I'm looking forward to the city. I think actually that many Christians are looking forward to their own little sheltered housing flat in heaven, which will be beautifully equipped, and say, I'm looking forward to that place that's going to be lovely for me. That's not looking forward to a city. That's looking forward to your own little cubbyhole. And that is not the vision that stirs people to any sort of sacrifice whatsoever. But the vision that we are meant to have is not a vision of me, but of us and them, a world community saved by Jesus. And that's what he looked forward to. A city with foundations, he says, because this isn't a pipe dream, this is reality. This is the way things really are. And this is what God's building now. A city with foundations, they're laid already, whose architect and builder is God. Do you want to be involved in what God's doing now? What is God doing now? What is God ruling the world for now, to build his church? So that is my first bit. Faith for Abraham meant going, and going with that vision. Faith, secondly, in relation to Abraham, was a husband and wife business. Verses 11 and 12. And unless you stay single, that's the way that it needs to be. The Lord may give you the charisma, as the New Testament puts it, of being single, either for the time being or for life. Recognize it as a charisma, as a gift of the Spirit, because that's what it's called. You say, well, it's not what I chose. But it's very interesting the way that in Matthew chapter, isn't it 18, where Jesus is talking about divorce? Matthew 18, where he's talking about divorce, and the disciples turn around and say, crumbs, if that's what it's like to be married, it's better to be single and happy. Do you remember the disciples said that? Yeah, they did. Jesus says, well, it depends on the gift. He turns around and he says, it depends on the gift. No, it's chapter 19. There you are. He says, not everyone can accept the word, but only those to whom it is given, verse 11. For some are eunuchs because they were born that way. Some stay single because of the way that they're born. Others were made that way by men. They didn't choose it for themselves. Others did it. You know, you may say, well, the bloke never got round to proposing, silly fellow. Others have renounced marriage because of the kingdom of heaven. Now, the interesting thing is, he doesn't say those who've renounced it, as it were, as a deliberate decision, they've got a special gift, and the others are lumbered. He uses the term given of all three, because he is sovereign. And the point is that when in 1 Corinthians 7 it talks about marriage and singleness as a charisma, and it uses the same word that is used of tongues and healing and prophecy and the rest of it, the gifts of God are given for the building up of the church. They're not always easy. People say, all right, well, you've got a gift of preaching, yes, but it tears my heart out and it leaves me exhausted and sometimes I can't sleep. There is a cost to be paid in exercising gifts, and there is a cost to be paid in relation to using your gift of singleness or marriage for the building up of the church. But there's the importance of seeing that what you are and the state that you are in is part of the moulding that God has given, as it were, to direct your service and ministry. But if the Lord gives you a partner, then it's very important that your faith walk should be a husband and wife business. There's a lovely Greek ambiguity in here. It's rather difficult to know how to translate it. The NIV, which at times is somewhat chauvinistic in its translation, opts for the Abraham-orientated though it does put in the notes that it could be a Sarah-orientated one. By faith, Abraham, even though he was past the age and Sarah herself was barren, was enabled to become a father because he considered him faithful who had made the promise. Or, as it says in the notes, by faith even Sarah, who was past the age, was enabled to bear children because she believed. It's absolutely the most lovely passage. It delights me. Now, whose faith was it? The NIV text says it was Abraham's, and the margin says it was Sarah's. I suggest to you that when the scripture is ambiguous, you need to take both meanings. Because the Spirit of God wouldn't have made it ambiguous otherwise. It's a couple who trusted the Lord. It's rather lovely, actually, isn't it? I have a terribly visual imagination. And here you are, you see, can you imagine the sort of discussion, you know? I mean, it's all right when you're around 30 and you wander around in a smock, but she was 90, you see. And you sort of think, oh, poor old dear, she's probably got a tumour. But no, it isn't. You don't say, but she's past it. You know, she's 40 years on from the change. And there she is, you see. And she's expecting a baby. Well, they've written them off and said, well, poor dears, they can't, you see. And do you remember when the three blokes from heaven visited in Genesis? And of course they discussed with Abraham about his wife having a baby. And said, well, she's going to conceive before we come back, you see. And Sarah was behind the tent door listening in, because, I mean, it did affect her, didn't it? So it was worth her knowing. And she hears them saying she's going to have a baby, and she has a quiet giggle. And they said, you laughed? She says, I didn't. They said, oh, yes, you did. Well, wouldn't you, if you were 90 and were told you were going to have your first child? You'd throw a fit, wouldn't you? Well, imagine. But the lovely thing is, you see, that for all the giggles and the, oh, I don't know about that, it tells us here that actually they reached the point together where they could trust the Lord that if he promised something that seemed in their society and in science and in terms of their experience as men and women with normal physical functions, that it really wasn't on. That if God said it, then that was it, and they would trust the Lord and go ahead together. Now that's very important, you see. They together trusted the Lord. Now perhaps some of you are courting here. Some of you are married. Will your relationship lead to that walking and trusting the Lord, what he said, whatever the evidence seems to be? Even when you're on pension, it's all miracles. Because wonderful things happen when ordinary people trust the Lord. Do you see what they did? They thought about God's faithfulness, verse 11. That's nice, isn't it? They thought about it. They considered him faithful. They turned over in his mind their experience of God and they said, it's amazing, isn't it? But the God that we're dealing with, he is reliable, isn't he? Do you remember how we proved him reliable in this? They'd have said, do you remember how he was reliable when he promised that? Well, if he's reliable like that, then if he's made another promise, let's enter into it together. They considered, they thought about it. When we face obstacles and things that God is calling us to that seem just beyond us, think about the faithfulness of God as you've discovered it up till now. And the beautiful thing is that here's a couple that trust the Lord and encourage one another to trust the Lord together for all their giggles. And the blessing lasted a lot longer than they did, didn't it? A believing home, a believing partnership can lead to generations of blessing somewhere. Now what is this life of faith to which we are called? Let me suggest to you one or two things from verses 11 to 22 that we can apply to ourselves. One, it's a commitment for life, not a young person's hobby. By faith, Abraham, even when he was past the age, and Sarah herself were barren, were enabled to be father because he considered him faithful who made the promise. In other words, this sort of life that we're talking about is not what can I do before I settle down. This adventure is right for every age group. The adventure of faith, this venture of going out with God. It is a commitment to perhaps only be the start of things. Verse 13 said, they didn't receive the things promised. They only saw them and welcomed them from a distance. They saw it on the horizon. So different from the sort of missionary mindset that says, well, I witnessed him for 5 minutes and he didn't become a Christian, so it's a waste of time, isn't it? Think of that couple that had that Iranian girl at their home every Sunday for 2 years. Think of the availability that was made for her. And they didn't see an inch of response, but she was converted. And they did most of the work. And so they pressed on, you see, these people. And it led them to an attitude of mind where they could say to one another, and they could say to their kids down the generations, we haven't got it yet, but it's right. Now, I find that very moving, this peculiar bit of all the blessings and the desires about the bones. And what are you going to do with my bones in verses 20 to 22? Because you see what's happening. They're saying to their kids, no, we haven't got it yet, but God promised it, so you're going to go on in the same way, aren't you? Can you imagine that sort of mindset? It's a very important mindset, isn't it? It's very different from some things. You know, David Ellis, who headed up the team in Indonesia for about 20 years, well, not quite for that long, but I mean, he was there for over 20 years. His uncle was a missionary to Muslims in Algeria. He worked for 50 years, and he saw two people converted, and both of them were murdered by having ground glass put in their food. But you see, here is a man, he has devoted himself to what needs to be done, and he sees, as it were, just two fruit. He sees the beginning of what God's purposing to do, but it's only on the horizon. But that man has an influence on David, who sees much fruit in a predominantly Muslim nation of Indonesia. You see? You're passing it on to the next generation, saying, this business that we are committed to, it is the winning thing, even if you don't see the fruit yet. That's the commitment, you see. And so they bless the next generation, and they say, you're to take my bones to the promised land. And they have this box of bones that they're carting around with them. Can you imagine? You credit it. This is this fantastic souvenir that they've got. The old boy's bones. And they're not going to bury them. No, we're not going to bury them. Because he wants this to be a reminder to us that God's promised it and it's coming. That's beautiful. I think it's very exciting. So I'm glad I don't have to carry a box of my grandpa's bones around with me. A commitment to be only the starting. A commitment to be different. You see, these folk, they're obviously citizens of heaven. Do you see that? Verse 13 and 14. They admitted that they were aliens and strangers on earth. People who say such things show that they're looking for a country of their own. They show that. You're different. You know how it is. I mean, I come here, anybody can tell you. You just have to listen. You know I'm a pom, don't you? You know, you've got a different accent, you've got a different way of talking, you know. Folk, it says it sticks out. Well, it's about these people. It stuck out that they belong somewhere else. Not, oh, you've got that accent. But you're going somewhere different, aren't you? You're going with God. You're prepared to be different. Not different as a foreigner in the sense of having a different earthly culture, but different in the sense that you belong to God. And they were prepared to be different in that way. And they were committed not to look back. Not to hanker for the old life. Look at verse 15. If they had been thinking of the country they had left, they would have had opportunity to return. Instead, they were longing for a better country, a heavenly one. That's a very important thing to think about, isn't it? The devil puts it in your mind all the time. You know, if you're there in central Thailand in that sort of stinking heat, flogging your guts out, feeling, oh, when are the reinforcements going to come? And you get a beautiful hankering and a sort of vision of Mount Tambourine and Oh, you just say, oh, that's enough. Well, the Lord does bring us backwards and forwards at different times. He shoves us around. He makes us mobile. He uses in one place at one time, one place another. I never dreamt the Lord would take me from the Philippines to Scotland. It gives me the creeps, but never mind, it makes sense. And the Lord does take us back. But the thing is that the basically is being put in here is this. That you can be doing like Jonah does in Nineveh and sort of looking over your shoulder and saying, just think, if it wasn't for God, I could be in Tarshish. If it wasn't for God. And you're looking over your shoulder at what God has asked you to leave for the sake of Him. I love the way in the New Testament you get in Philippians this very extraordinary thing. Paul talks about all the things that he's had to leave because of God's plan for his life. And you know what he says he calls it? And did you enjoy your porridge this morning? It's nice, wasn't it? And I tell you something very wonderful about the porridge that we had this morning. It's doing you good. Although it's soft and seems to slide down beautifully, it's full of roughage. And it is doing you good. As long as it's inside you. When it passes through, and I'm sorry if this is too earthy for you, but it's a good Filipino-style illustration anyway. When it passes through, you don't turn round and look in the pan and say, oh, what a pity. Oh, that I could have it back. Now, listen, this is very important, you see. There are things that the Lord asks us to let go of that are not bad things. They are things that at the present are good for us and good in our lives. Right? But if in the purposes of God is going to take you on and say, leave that to receive this, then it's very important that you adopt the apostolic mindset that calls it done. It did me good, but if I were to hang on to it now, it would be harmful. Not because it was harmful, but because now it has been part of me and I'm going to leave it behind. And to hanker for it is as silly as turning around and looking down the loo and saying, oh shucks, I wanted that. He says, regard it as done. But I find again and again and again that what the devil does is he makes you focus on what you've had to leave behind in order to go on in the Lord's will. And if that is your focus, you'll go back. You'll go back. And you will become like, as it were, a person who is physically bunged up, hanging on to what he should let go. And be a sick Christian. Do you see what I'm trying to say? It's important because the Lord doesn't just say, let go of sin for me. He sometimes says, let go of good things. And then you need to let go. And it's a commitment that we're called to that is to be heavenly minded. Heavenly minded, verse 16. God's prepared a city for us. You're longing for heaven? You need to long for heaven. It'll set you free to serve. Somebody told me that there were 339,400 people martyred last year. I think that's probably an exaggeration. But we do need to be prepared, yes, even to die for Christ. But the thing that I find about these people that is so lovely is it says God isn't ashamed to be called their God. He's not ashamed to risk his reputation being bound up with people like you and me. And that's a very amazing thing. We can make ourselves available. We can trust him. We can reason with ourselves. Haven't we proved God faithful up to now? Come on, let's move on with him. Will you trust him? Of course you should trust him, but will you? Can you settle it with God that you trust him? To be available for him, not just willing to go, but planning to stay, but willing or wanting to go where he wants us. With your partner, if you have one. Till you die, living by faith. Living, trusting him. I wonder what it is that we're going to do. Whoops. what you're going to do because you've been here. There are a number of steps of faith that you might need to take. Then I've put one or two of them up. It may be that your responsibility will be to share some of the biblical issues that relate to mission. To communicate that, because it's amazing how often folk are able to teach the Bible as a thing for me, but with, as it were, completely ignoring the missionary thrust that starts in Genesis and ends in Revelation and is there all the way through. It may be that you need to pass on some of the teaching that the challenge of mission may reach to others. Certainly we need to work, as we're able, to integrate mission into normal church life. You will find that some churches have what you call a missionary weekend or a missionary conference where they do mission for the year. And the rest of the time, the rest of the world can go to pot because we're too busy doing our thing. But it's actually quite important that in your normal church prayer meeting there should be a reaching out to the world. That in the normal teaching in Sunday school there should be this dimension, so you pick up some of the kids' books and in this sort of way try to integrate. Some of you, your commitment may be to get cross-cultural experience. And that's a very important thing. You can get it in Brisbane, almost certainly. And for some of you, it may mean travelling a bit further if you've got the shekels to do it. Fourthly, for you, it ought to be that you will aim to send people out. In one sense, we're all missionaries, just as in one sense, we're all pastors. But only in the same sense that we're all pastors. We're not all set apart for a disciples-making ministry in the same way. Neither were they in the New Testament. That's why they use the term apostle or sent out ones in a secondary sense. We need to aim to be sending folk out and looking for likely folk to approach and praying for the Lord to fling them out. Fifthly, some of you, the challenge will be to get some others together to pray. When I was a student, I had a burden for Latin America. I got a bunch of friends to come round for breakfast once a week and pray with me. I cooked them porridge. And while we ate porridge, we talked about Latin America. They prayed for half an hour and ran like crazy for our lectures. It didn't actually demand an awful lot of work. But it did demand, just a small group of us, that commitment to work hard for somewhere else in prayer. It's not just the calling of old ladies, though it's wonderful that they can do it. Sixthly, I would suggest to you that if world mission means anything to you, as it does to me, then you will try, as I have tried, to invest as daringly as you can in world mission. I was very moved on one occasion. I was talking with a student about this. He said to me, well, it's impossible to live on my student grant. I was a bit freaked out because I knew that student grants in England at that, Scotland at that stage, were rather better than IMF remittances. So I said, I find it quite a reasonable amount with a fair bit to give away. He looked at me a bit startled. I said, well, what are your priorities in spending? He said, well, of course, I'm building quite a nice record collection. I said, that's very interesting. I said, I find that if you put the Lord first in your finances, that the Lord undertakes. That when I was first a Christian worker, I didn't reckon I could afford to give, and I borrowed money at the end of every month, and I was even more persuaded that I couldn't afford to give. And then I noticed that my fiancée was saving rather a lot, and she had the same salary as me, and rather more financial obligations. I started to put God first. I've often earned less than I did in those days. But I've not found myself in debt since. I shared this with this bloke. A little while later he came round to me with a cheque. I said, what's this? He said, well, it's from what I have for this next term. He said, I want you to send it to this work and that work and the other work. So I tried to fulfil his obligations, his instructions. And he came round at the beginning of the next term and here was another cheque. Will you send it this way, that way, the other way? I tried to do it. I said, are you making ends meet these days? Oh yes, he said, isn't it wonderful? I said, I thought that your grant was too small. He says, well, it's funny when you put the Lord works first, what a difference it makes, isn't it? Let me just ask you a question. We reviewed our missionary finances in my home church. In my home church, we sent out about 20 missionaries, so we sent them all a Christmas present. And wondered why many of them put them into their support gift funds of their missionary societies. And then somebody said, hey, don't you think we ought to be trying to pay something towards them? We computed that if we were going to fully support them, it would cost about $3 or $4 a week per committed member of the church. One bloke said to me, my goodness, he said, I spend more than that on ice cream and chocolate on a Friday night. He said, I think probably the evangelization of the world's worth more than ice cream and chocolate, don't you? If you're burdened about mission, it will show. And that's true if you're a missionary or Christian worker as well as if you're earning a packet. It will show in that. Lastly, two things with missionaries. Like rope them in if they come home to help you evangelize, because if you sent them out to evangelize, they might possibly have gifts in that way.